Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
October 14th, 2011, the Norris Group returned with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An expert lineup of industry specialists joined Bruce Norris to discuss current industry regulation, head-scratching legislation, and the opportunities emerging for savvy real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops with President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Real Wealth Networks, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. The event video can be found on isurvived2011.com.
It seems like when there's an REO created now that there's a series of things that happen, including both of that, a couple of BPOs and an appraisal.
Yes.
I'm not sure which one they weigh heavier or not, but there's evidence that everybody's getting a turn at saying what the value is. Do you see anything in Dodd-Frank or the changes in qualified mortgage that threaten a 30-year mortgage for some of the stratuses of loans? I'm just curious if we're going to have the supply of money that wants to go out that long.
Yeah, I don't probably see anything in the QM or the QRM that would specifically attack the 30-year mortgage. For the most part, that's certainly been a product that America, housing in America, has depended on for many, many, many years. And I don't personally worry about the 30-year mortgage going away as a result of the regulation.
Okay. is there any discussion about where Fannie and Freddie will end up? Is that, and I'm, of course, I'm going to get some more opinions on that, but is there any concern that they're going to be smaller by quite a bit?
Yeah, I think our fragile housing market right now is delaying certainly the government's desire to shrink the footprint in housing. The white paper at the beginning of this year would launch the debate for the future of the government's role in housing, the future of the GSEs, and how to rebuild the nation's secondary mortgage markets. I don't think probably the debate is really going to get going until maybe after the elections. So I think the future of the GSEs, there's a couple of bills that have been introduced that would suggest, all the way from totally privatizing what would now be Fannie and Freddie, to maybe private companies with a government wrap for the securities that are issued. But debate probably won't start until the end of next year.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and have our other three panelists come on up, and we will start another train of questions. One of the things I read recently was a Moody's report that talked about, with the qualified residential mortgage in place, and it referred to FHA as probably only being 10% of the market. And that really surprised me, because almost in California, even on the low side, first-time buyers are 30%, and a high side 50% in a market like now. How could FHA be only 10% unless it was really being restricted?
In the future.
Yeah. So I guess that's what I was wondering. What would be the restriction to prevent that from being a normal percentage? Because that would be the loan you would think those people would go to.
Yeah, I think, if you look at what the government's willing to do to get FHA from a 30-something percent market share down to maybe a target of 10 to 15%, they've already raised the mortgage insurance premium. So an FHA loan is slightly more expensive than it was. We've just seen the stimulus loan limits expire, and so there's another little nudge toward a smaller market share. There's been talk about, looking at a median income restriction somewhere in our future. I don't think we're going to see any of that anytime soon, but I think we're going to see small moves to get that market share down from about 30-something percent.
I think it's part of it. It'll be part of the discussion of getting the private market more involved. If you go back to some of the history of the FHA loans, the underlying theory for FHA was that there was a part of the credit spectrum that wouldn't get served by the private market because the returns probably didn't reach private market returns, and that there were external benefits from encouraging home ownership by providing a subsidy through the FHA program to get credit to those households. But in return for that, there was also a ceiling on the size of loan that was available in the market. So you may also see some discussion of that come up again. But I think it will all be done in context of what they do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right. How big of a deal do you think lowering the loan balance is? We asked that before, but I got to, just from the numbers that I know, for instance, in California, we had a median price of $600,000. We now have a median price of under $3,000. And even if they reduce the loan limit, it has to serve more households with the new loan limit than it served the big loan limit, because there's a lot less expensive homes, at least going forward. Now, you might have a problem with refis. I could see that being a problem. But I don't know that are we supposed to have a government program that's over twice the median price of an area. That probably is not true.
If you look in our book of business between the previous limit and the conforming limit to where it dropped, it was less than 5% of our book. The problem is it's regionally targeted, right? So California is going to get New Jersey, places like that.
Maryland, Washington, your high-cost markets are obviously hit more than the national. We modeled our business, and the impact is very small. Although you got a question, anything right now that would be negative to housing, is that what we really want to be doing?
Just on the loan limits thing, one of the things that always, I find interesting about these federal programs, right, is it's at the county level. And one of the biggest drops that we had here in California was in Monterey County, where you have Watsonville that's pretty close to, Carmel, Pebble Beach, and Monterey. And these are two completely different markets, even though they're, 15 miles apart. And so Monterey and Carmel are going to take a $200,000 hit on the conforming loan limit, whereas, areas in San Jose and Contra Costa County and those areas that aren't as desirable aren't going to take as big a hit. It makes no sense.
That's a true statement. I hadn't really thought about that. That happens in every place that they make that decision. Like in Orange County, that would be not a factor in Santa Ana.
Right.
But it would be a factor in Newport Beach.
In Newport Beach it is. That's right.
Yeah.
That goes back to that comment that we made earlier about applying a broad-based national policy to anything. It overrides all of the local conditions that require some of the expertise that was being talked about in the appraisal space and a whole host of other things that relate to real estate. For a long time period, we looked at the national house price, and then we talked to our friends and neighbors about all real estate is local.
Mm-hmm. There's a document that talks about let's try to save whatever it is, $2 trillion or $4 trillion off of the budget going forward. And real estate would obviously be a natural target for trying to get some of our chips. And so is that something that is, I don't know, have we thought about what might be okay to take, or are we going to go, can't have any of it? I asked that of this group, by the way. We had a questionnaire, and I would say a good half said it's not okay to take any of it. But I wonder if it's not going to happen one way or the other. So which of the, like an interest rate deduction going down to $500,000, is that impactful, do you think, to our market?
Well, we think it is. National Association of Realtors does.
Okay.
You know, we do not think that that should be touched at all. And because of the unintended consequences, no matter where you go, one of the proposals is you do it on second homes in resort markets. Well, what does that do to the resort market, and what does it do to those communities where you can't resell properties? And, you know, the unintended consequences is, you know, it affects the grocery store, it affects the pharmacist, it affects everybody. It doesn't just affect the person that owns that property and can't deduct it anymore. So,
well, I agree with Bruce. It's a real target because it's a government subsidy, and subsidies on both the ideological camps are obvious targets for cuts. And of course, it's always the other guy's subsidy that's a bad one, not your own.
That's right.
So, I think that it's likely to happen. I'm not sure if it would have as big an impact as everyone thinks it would. I think the real big problem we have right now is, incomes and employment. I mean,
correct.
If we're not really going to fix the housing problem, all these are marginal issues and not marginal solutions until we start having job growth.
Well, why don't we talk about that? Because you and I talked a little bit about it over lunch. Riverside County is 15% unemployment, and usually we really count on construction.
That's right.
But we have a price per square foot on some inventory that's half of construction cost. So it's like the dominoes almost have to fall backwards before they can fall forward. We have to get rid of a lot of what we would consider shadow inventory. So why don't we start there? Let's talk about shadow inventory and see if we're on the same page of what it is and what to do about it. Because I think until you end up with that disseminated into the marketplace to where no one fears it coming out later at below replacement costs, then you can finally go forward. So, Sean, I'm going to ask you, because you get to talk about shadow inventory probably a lot. What's the newest version of what it is? Because it has changed.
Well, I think it moves to help provide cover for whoever got it wrong the first time. it started out, when we first started talking about it, was in 2008, and you had foreclosures just on a tear, banks taking back lots of property, and we weren't seeing that property back on the market. And it occurred to us, wow, the banks are really holding a lot of property that's not making it through to the market. And so that's what we talked about originally is shadow inventory, and we had some early stats on that. And then a lot of people, talking about the foreclosure wave and other things, needed to change that over time. And it's grown to then include everyone in foreclosure. Okay, that makes sense. Everyone who's delinquent, okay. Everyone that's in negative equity. And I've heard others say, well, it also includes all those who would like to sell at the prices that are in 2006, but now can't.
Everybody that owns.
That's the delusional inventory.
Yeah, that's the delusional inventory, yes. Yeah, so that's a good, I love that. And but make no mistake about it. I mean, start talking to folks, start talking to your neighbors. There is a lot of delusional inventory.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of property that should be and would be on the market if people weren't still holding out some hope that there's going to be some fix in Washington. And I think that's as big a problem as anything else.
Well, I mean, I think, for instance, in some markets, you have 3,000 square foot houses that cost a lot to build being bought for $140,000. And there might be a pile of them. So that shadow inventory is not just what the lender owns. It's what's being refused to be foreclosed on. At least that's where I would go with shadow inventory, is this ball of two-year late people that for whatever reason aren't being forced to the finish line. Now, give some credit to MERS or robo-signing or whatever, but long before that became a front-line issue, it looks like lenders made a decision, let's just don't foreclose on that. So what's the reasoning behind waiting so long, if that's a fair question?
Why is there some people waiting for prices to return
lenders
to normal?
Yeah, well, just a second.
Why are the lenders
let me just say one other thing before, is that the last time we had this problem was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And lenders started to wait. And people were getting close to a year behind. And the FDIC came over the top and said, And I remember the chart, because I'm really connected to charts, and you had foreclosures decline in 95 in California, and yet delinquencies went up. And there was a rule passed that when you're 100 days late, you have to file an NOD. And that came basically from instruction. And this time, it seems like not only there wasn't there an instruction, there was a free pass, and just say whenever you want to, or if you don't want to, it's okay. So what changed, and why is that?
Well, isn't it largely because there's not a large enough pool of creditworthy buyers by the new definition of creditworthy?
Well, I would say that if you wanted to sell it to investors, you would have all you could give to the market. Yeah. But I don't know that that's the reason. I don't think that there's a fear that there's not enough cash even, because, well, how much gets bought at trustee sales every month? It's a lot of money.
I don't get the sense that lenders are delaying foreclosure by design as much as working through the process, meeting regulations, meeting investor requirements, state requirements, et cetera, et cetera. Unless there's REOs that they haven't put back out on the market, I don't get the sense that lenders are purposely delaying the foreclosure process. By the same token, I think lenders are going overboard right now to make sure they're doing the responsible loss mitigation activities that they need to do to help keep borrowers in their homes, or structure short sales, or whatever the appropriate process is, one buyer at a time.
I think they're also trying to figure out who owns the loan.
I mean, honestly, we had more than double the foreclosures that we have today in 2008. So this idea, this notion that the lenders need more time to figure this out is, you know, it's ridiculous, right? Just on its face, flat out ridiculous. They've had plenty of time to figure it out. We're 4 years into this thing, right? That's not the problem. I think Doug touched on it earlier when he said, look, you know, at Fannie and Freddie, we're really, you know, we don't really want to talk about principal balance reductions. We're worried about foreclosures because ultimately these losses, you know, flow through to the taxpayer. And the taxpayer is not really in much position, you know, to take them right now. And so, I mean, it's really clear to me, and neither are the banks. I mean, you start looking at just the seconds that a bank has that are, you know, maybe the firsts are held by Fannie and Freddie, but they've got this portfolio of seconds that are on their portfolio, right, that exceed the equity of the institution. So you really start clearing this stuff through, you've got a much different problem than, you know, just simply doing processing the paperwork. You're talking about national, you know, certainly so, banking and government solvency.
Yeah, in some sense, it's a grand social experiment of the question, would the welfare of the economy and the populace be better served by a rapid and deep clearing of inventory, which would bring into question the solvency of a significant part of the financial system, or do you get a better result through a variety of policies to make a slow move to bring prices back into equilibrium? There's basically an experiment underway to test that.
And I think that would be great, except right now it's extend and pretend, because, you know, take that, say, hey, look, we've got more losses here than we can afford to bear, right? Fess up with the American people that that's really the situation, and we're going to, on purpose, drag this out so that we have an orderly, you know, dissolution like in Greece, right, rather than a disorderly one. And I think the longer we continue to extend and pretend and not have a conversation about how bad it really is, we created $4 trillion of excess mortgage debt. We've worked through half a trillion of it so far. We've got $3.5 trillion to go. We can't afford it today. And so we've got to have a different solution.
You know, well, one of the things that I do a lot of studying of charts, and so one of the things that I noticed that in 08, when we really had a lot of price damage, when I was buying houses for 18 cents on what the lender was owed, that was really the number because there was so much inventory. At that time, our default was, say, 3.4%, and our foreclosures were 1.2%. About 9 months later, our defaults were 11%, and our foreclosures were 0.08, and they just stopped foreclosing. You had tripled the default. And one of the disservices it does is there's gentlemen in this audience at the time of 08 had 800 REO listings and had a business plan around that volume. Mm-hmm. And was never told that was going to turn into 200. And that's one of the things that would have been helpful, is to tell an industry, we just simply won't do this at this pace anymore, and they could have had a better business plan. That is one thing that would be frustrating. Mortgage people, too, or appraisers, too. I mean, that's all business that's churning in that red ball behind us that's not producing a fee or a commission or a rental. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we might surprise, especially if you could put deed restrictions on. And maybe you're right. By the way, those losses that are, I'm talking about what you just mentioned, in second position, buying a first that's a 200% loan to value, is that being booked at zero value, or is that being booked at face note value? I'm just curious. Anybody know?
Well, I mean, back in 2008, when Paulson announced TARP, you know, everybody thought it was about loans to banks. But if you go back and read his statement, it was really about, we shouldn't force these banks to sell these properties into this distressed market at these distressed prices. And that sounded good on paper, except this wasn't a distressed price. This was a reversion to the mean. This is the price that things were supposed to be at. And these losses are real, and we need to figure out how we recognize them and deal with them. And 4 years later, we haven't even started having an honest discussion about recognizing them and dealing with them.
Well, I mean, what would happen if we said, okay, let's foreclose on that red ball? Is that, do you absorb $4 million and survive?
Trillion?
Four. I'm not a big thinker, I guess.
I think, you know, Doug may be right. Maybe we, you know, need to think about a different social, you know, experiment. But let's have that conversation. I mean, at the end of the day, what we need is a clear housing policy, because I think most people realize that extend and pretend's not working. And that's one of the reasons we're not seeing home sales take off in Riverside, where it's now, you know, an incredible bargain.
I think it's hard
historic terms.
It's hard to take risk when you don't know the rules of the game.
Well, you certainly have a lot of uncertainty in the lending community right now, waiting for regulation, waiting to understand the government's role, so that there is a lot of uncertainty in that regard. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was going to say, just a clue about what the population is thinking. As I mentioned before, we've been surveying 1,000 people a month for 16 months. So we get, and it's available on our website. You can see we publish it the 7th.
Yeah, it's a good report. I read it.
Yeah, and so we ask them about their expectation on interest rates, on prices, all these things. But in the most recent quarter, we also asked them what they thought about the stability of their to go back to the question of employment. And 26% of the people who were employed were worried about being able to stay employed.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2011. Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Conaway and Conaway, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan and Clark Partners LLC, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Pacific Sunrise Mortgage, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Raven Paul & Company, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Tri-Emerald Financial Group, and Weston South Coast Plaza. Visit isurvived2011.com for more details.